Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something really, well, elegant. Gauss's Law.
Yeah, it's like this remarkably clever shortcut
Yeah.
for understanding electric fields.
Especially when you've got symmetry involved. We've got some insightful excerpts from a physics textbook that'll be our guides today.
Right. And our mission really is to unpack Gauss's law by, well, putting it to work. We'll dive into three classic scenarios:
Okay.
the electric field around an infinitely long charged wire, then a uniformly charged infinite plane, and finally, a uniformly charged spherical shell.
Right, these classic examples.
Yeah, and they might sound a bit theoretical, maybe a little abstract,
Yeah.
but they actually reveal some really fundamental truth, often quite surprising ones, about how electric fields behave.
Absolutely. And listeners should, prepare for some genuine aha moments. Like, we'll see how the field from that infinite wire gets surprisingly simple. Depends only on how far away you are radially. Or how a charged sphere from the outside acts just like all its charges squished down to a point at the center.
Exactly. It's all about leveraging that symmetry.
Okay, let's dive in then. Starting with that infinitely long, uniformly charged wire.
Okay, so picture this wire just stretching out forever in both directions, and it's got a uniform positive charge spread all along it.
Right.
Now, to talk about how much charge is on it, we use something called linear charge density. We use the Greek letter lambda for that.
Okay, lambda, so that's like charge per meter or charge per unit length.
Exactly. Think of it like charge per meter. If you had a really long string and sprinkled charge evenly, lambda tells you how much charge is in each meter of that string.
Got it. Now, the symmetry here is key, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's everything. If you imagine standing a certain distance away from the wire and you just walk in a perfect circle around it, keeping that distance the same,
Yeah.
the situation looks identical from every point on that circle. The physics doesn't change.
Right. Nothing looks different as you walk around.
And that symmetry forces the electric field to behave in a very specific way. For this infinite wire, the electric field has to point directly away from the wire, radially outward, if lambda is positive.
Or radially inward if it's negative charge.
Precisely. Why? Well, think about any two little bits of charge on the wire, equally distant up and down from your point.
Okay.
The parts of their fields that point along the wire cancel each other out perfectly. All you're left with is the component pointing straight out, the radial component.
Ah, I see. The sideways bits cancel.
Exactly. And because the wire is infinite, it doesn't matter where you are along the length of the wire either. The field strength at a given radius r is the same.
Okay, that makes sense. So, how do we use Gauss's law to actually, calculate this field? You mentioned choosing a special surface.
That's the trick. Gauss's law relates the electric flux. Think of it as the amount of electric field piercing through a closed surface to the total charge inside that surface.
Right, flux equals enclosed charge over epsilon naught.
You got it. So to make life easy, we choose an imaginary closed surface, our Gaussian surface, that matches the symmetry of the charge setup.
So for a long wire, something round?
A cylinder. Imagine a cylindrical can, basically, centered perfectly on the wire. Let's say it has a radius, the distance we're interested in, and some length L.
Okay, a cylinder coaxial with the wire. Why that shape specifically?
Because the curved side of the cylinder perfectly matches the radial symmetry of the electric field. The field lines will hit that curved surface straight on perpendicularly.
Ah, okay. And what about the flat ends of the cylinder?
Good question. Think about those two circular end caps. The electric field is pointing radially outward from the wire.
So it's running parallel to the surface of those end caps.
Exactly. It's just skimming along the surface. No field lines actually pierce through the end caps.
So the flux through the ends is zero.
Zero. Correct. All the flux goes through the curved sidewall.
Makes sense.
Now, on that curved surface, the electric field E is perpendicular everywhere.
Yeah.
And because of symmetry, it has the same strength, same magnitude, everywhere on that curved surface at radius r.
Okay.
The area of that curved surface is just the circumference times the length, right?
Right.
So 2 pax Ela.
Right, 2 pow.
So the total flux through our cylinder is just the field strength, E times that area, Ea 2 pal. That's the left side of Gauss's law.
Okay, flux is E times 2 pow. Now for the right side, the enclosed charge, how much charge is inside our imaginary cylinder of length L?
Well, we know the charge per unit length is lambda, and our cylinder has length L.
So just lambda times L.
Simple as that. That's the charge enclosed, can
All
close.
right, so putting it all together with Gauss's law, E times 2 pow equals L divided by A.
Ea2 barrel equals L lit.
Exactly. E2 parallel equals all A.
The L cancels out on both sides.
It does. That's convenient. And if you rearrange to solve for E, you get
E eat 2 pow. Wow.
Pretty neat, huh? The electric field strength depends directly on the linear charge density and inversely on the distance r. That's much simpler than the 1 over r squared for a point charge.
It is. That 1 over dependence is characteristic of line charges.
Mm-hmm.
More charge density, stronger field. Further away, weaker field, but only falling off as 1r.
And we can write this as a vector too, can't we? To show the direction?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
The vector E is just the 2-pick times a little unit vector, n hat, that points radially outward from the wire.
And if Oak is negative, the field just points inward, opposite to NO.
Perfect.
Now, you stressed earlier that the wire has to be infinitely long for this formula to be exact. Why is that so crucial?
Yes. The infinite length is what guarantees that perfect radial symmetry and cancellation of components along the wire.
Mm.
If the wire had ends,
uh-huh.
close to those ends, the field lines would start to bulge outwards. They wouldn't be purely radial anymore. And the field strength wouldn't be constant along our Gaussian cylinder. We call those end effects or fringing fields.
So the calculation wouldn't work out so cleanly.
Exactly. Our simple Gaussian surface argument breaks down near the ends. But for a long wire, this formula E to Barrow is a really good approximation for the field near the middle, far from the ends.
Okay, that makes sense. The idealization helps us get a very useful result, even if it's an approximation in the real world.
Precisely. It captures the essential physics away from the messy bits at the ends.
All right, let's switch gears. What about the second scenario? The uniformly charged infinite plane sheet.
Okay, new geometry. Imagine a huge flat sheet, like an infinite piece of paper stretching out forever, and it has a uniform surface charge density, sigma.
So now it's charge per unit area, not length.
Exactly. Coulombs per square meter, for instance. Sigma tells us how densely the charge is packed onto the surface.
Okay. What does symmetry tell us here? The field must point away from the sheet.
Perpendicular to the sheet, yes. If sigma is positive, the field points directly away from the sheet on both sides. If sigma is negative, it points directly towards the sheet.
And why perpendicular? Same kind of cancellation argument.
Pretty much. For any point above the sheet, you can imagine pairing up bits of charge on the sheet. Any field components parallel to the sheet will cancel out due to symmetry, leaving only the component perpendicular to the sheet.
And the field strength shouldn't depend on where you are parallel to the sheet, right? Just how far away you are perpendicularly?
Correct. Let's say the sheet is in the YZ plane. The field should only depend on the X coordinate, the distance from the plane.
So for our Gaussian surface this time, something that reflects that planar symmetry, a box.
A box works great, or a small cylinder oriented with its axis perpendicular to the sheet. Let's stick with a box, maybe a rectangular one, often called a Gaussian pillbox.
Okay, a little box. How should we orient it?
Imagine it sort of straddling the plane. So the top face, area A, is parallel to the sheet at some distance x above, and the bottom face, also area A, is parallel at the same distance x below.
Okay, centered on the sheet and the sides of the box.
The sides are perpendicular to the sheet. This is useful because the electric field is parallel to those sides.
Ah, so the flux through those sidewalls will be zero, just like the end caps of the cylinder before.
Exactly. E is parallel to the surface vector on the sides, so cos 90 degrees equals zero, meaning zero flux through the sides.
So all the flux must go through the top and bottom faces, the ones parallel to the sheet.
Right. And since the field E points perpendicularly away from the sheet, assuming positive sigma, it pierces straight through the top face, area A, and straight through the bottom face, area A.
Okay. So the flux through the top is E times A.
Yep. And the flux through the bottom is also E times A. Remember, flux is about field lines leaving the closed surface. On the bottom, E points down, but the outward normal also points down, so the flux is positive EA there too.
Ah, okay. So the total flux is EA plus EA equals 2EA.
Exactly. Total flux equals 2EA.
Now for the charge enclosed.
Our box cuts through the sheet, right? The area where it cuts through is A.
And the charge density is sigma, charge per area.
So the enclosed charge is just sigma times A.
Perfect. Now we apply Gauss's law, total flux, enclosed charge.
So 2EA equals AA. Look what happens again.
The area A cancels out. That's amazing.
Well, it is pretty remarkable. You solve for E and you get E equals to 2.
Wait a second. Look at that formula. E, there's no X or distance variable in there.
That's the stunning result for an infinite plane sheet.
Yes.
The electric field strength is constant. It doesn't depend on how far away you are from the sheet.
That feels really counterintuitive. You move further away, but the field is just as strong.
For a truly infinite plane, yes. It seems weird, but it's a direct consequence of the geometry. As you move further away, you see more of the infinite plane, and the contributions from the further parts exactly compensate for the weakening field. From the closer parts, according to the 1R1 rule for point charges, resulting in a constant field.
Wow, okay. And the vector form?
Simple. Vector E times N, where N is a unit vector pointing perpendicularly away from the sheet. Again, the sign of tells you if E points along wetter or opposite to it.
And like the wire, this is perfectly true only for an infinite sheet.
Yes. Real sheets have edges. But for a large, flat charge sheet, this formula E is a very good approximation for the field near the center, well away from those fringing fields at the edges.
Okay, fascinating. Two down. Ready for the sphere? A uniformly charged, thin, spherical shell.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
So imagine a hollow ball, like a ping pong ball, but just the thin shell, radius R, and we spray charge evenly all over its surface, giving it a uniform surface charge density.
So charge per area again, but on a curved surface this time.
Right. Total charge Q would be times the surface area of the sphere, which is force R.
And the symmetry here is obviously spherical.
Absolutely. Everything looks the same if you rotate it around the center. This tells us the electric field must point radially straight out from the center if Q is positive, or straight in if Q is negative. And its strength can only depend on the distance R from the center.
So our Gaussian surface should definitely be another sphere.
The concentric sphere is the perfect choice, centered at the same point as the charged shell. We'll need to consider two cases, though.
Inside the shell and outside the shell.
Exactly. Let's start outside, where our distance R from the center is greater than the shell's radius R.
Okay, so we draw an imaginary Gaussian sphere of radius R, completely enclosing the charged shell.
Right. Now, on this Gaussian sphere, the electric field E has the same magnitude everywhere, and it's pointing radially outward, perfectly parallel to the surface, normal vector ds at every point.
So the flux calculation is easy again, just E times the area of the Gaussian sphere.
Exactly. Flux equals E, area sphere with radius R, equals E a force go.
Okay. And the charge enclosed by this big Gaussian sphere.
Oh, since our Gaussian sphere core completely surrounds the charged shell, radius R, it encloses all the charge Q that's on the shell. So Q enclosed equals Q force go.
Got it. So Gauss's law gives us E 4R equals Q R.
Perfect. Now solve for E.
E equals Q 4R. Hey, wait a minute.
What is it?
That's exactly the formula for the electric field of a point charge Q located at the origin.
Bingo. That's the incredibly powerful and, yes, surprising result. For any point outside a uniformly charged spherical shell, the electric field it creates is identical to the field that would be created if all the charge Q were concentrated into a single point at the center of the shell.
That simplifies things enormously. So if you're far away from a charged sphere, you can just pretend it's a point charge at its center.
As long as you're outside it, yes. In vector form, E equals Q4 carry R times R, the radial unit vector.
Amazing. Okay, now for the second case, inside the shell. So now our Gaussian sphere has a radius R that's less than R, RR.
Right, an imaginary sphere drawn inside the hollow charged shell.
The symmetry argument still holds, right? If there were a field, it would have to be radial and constant in magnitude on this smaller sphere.
Correct. So the flux, if there were a field E, would still be E ec ds 4.
But what about the enclosed charge? Our little Gaussian sphere is inside the shell where all the charge lives.
Exactly. All the charge Q resides on the shell at radius R. Our Gaussian surface, with RR, is entirely within that shell.
So, there's no charge inside it. Conclosed equals zero.
Precisely. For a thin shell, all the charge is on the surface. There's zero charge enclosed within any radius smaller than R.
So Gauss's law becomes E A4R equals zero H, which means?
E equals zero. The electric field inside a uniformly charged thin spherical shell is zero everywhere inside.
Zero field inside. Even though there's charge all around it, that's another really striking result.
It really is. It comes directly from the warm and alternate nature of Coulomb's law and the spherical symmetry. The contributions from all the charge elements on the shell cancel out perfectly at any point inside.
And you mentioned this is experimentally verified.
Yes. The fact that there's no field inside a charge conductor, which is where the charge resides on the surface, is a well-verified experimental fact and provides strong support for the inverse square law. It's the basis for electrostatic shielding, like in a Faraday cage.
Wow. Okay, so Gauss's law gives us these really clear results for these symmetric shapes.
It does. And to see how we can combine these ideas, the textbook example of an early atomic model is quite instructive.
Ah, yes, the atom model. Tell us about that. Not the modern one, obviously.
No, this was an early simplified picture. Imagine a positive point nucleus, charge, plus Z, like Z protons, right at the center.
Okay.
And surrounding it, a sphere of uniformly distributed negative charge out to a radius R. Think of it like a uniform cloud or jelly of negative charge.
And the whole atom is neutral.
Yes, that's key. So the total negative charge in that cloud must be at a Z to balance the nucleus.
Okay, so plus Z at the center and a total of ZZZ spread uniformly in a sphere of radius R. What's though? Find the electric field.
Find the electric field E as a function of distance R from the nucleus, both inside the cloud or R and outside the cloud RR.
Right, we'll need that negative charge density first. Let's call it matter.
Good idea. The total negative charge is neb z, and it fills a volume of 43.
So the density is just charge over volume, meta z, 43. Got it.
Okay, first case. Inside the atom, R is z. We use a spherical Gaussian surface of radius r.
Flux is ERI44, assuming a radial field due to symmetry.
Correct. Now, the tricky part. Charge enclosed. What's inside our Gaussian sphere of radius r?
Well, there's definitely the nucleus plus z.
Yep. And there's also some of the negative cloud, right? The part within radius r.
Okay. The volume of our Gaussian sphere is 43 SAR. So the negative charge inside it is that volume times the density.
Exactly. Negative charge enclosed, 43 SAD.
Let's substitute that expression for, we found, negative charge in 43, Honolulu in 43. E3 through R cancels, negative charge enclosed.
Perfect. So the total enclosed charge, kenclosed, is the positive nucleus plus this negative part.
Kenclosed plus Z plus Z plus Z, 1, 1.
Excellent. Now, Gauss's law, EAR41 equals enclosed A's.
So ERX4R equals Z11.
They're just divide by 4 to solve for ER.
ER is a 4 for ER. Or if you distribute the 4 or R, E41RR. That's the field inside the atom model.
Nicely done. It points radially outward, assuming Z is positive, because for R, the term in the parentheses is positive. The positive nucleus dominates close in.
Okay, now for outside the atom model, RR, our Gaussian sphere now encloses the whole thing.
Right. Radius R. What's the total charge enclosed now?
Well, the whole atom is neutral, you said. So it encloses the plus Z nucleus and the entire neutral cloud.
Meaning the total enclosed charges.
0. Plus ZZ equals 0.
So Gauss's law says ER4, 4 equals 0E.
Which means ER equals 0 for all points outside this model atom.
Exactly. According to this early model, a neutral atom produces no external electric field.
And notice, if we plug ER into our inside formula, ER, ZER, Z41R, 1RD equals 0.
And the outside formula gives E obli 0 for RR, so it matches perfectly at the boundary RR. The field is 0 right at the edge and everywhere outside.
That's a really neat example showing how Gauss's law handles a slightly more complex but still symmetric distribution.
It really demonstrates the power of the method when symmetry is present.
So wrapping up this deep dive, it feels like Gauss's law is just this incredibly potent tool, doesn't it? Especially for these symmetric cases.
It absolutely is. It provides this often surprisingly simple pathway to calculate electric fields that would be, frankly, quite difficult to get by directly integrating Coulomb's law over the entire charge distribution.
We saw that with the infinite wire, the infinite plane, and the spherical shell. Those results were really elegant and, in the case of the plane and the inside of the shell, quite non-intuitive.
And the key takeaway really is always about identifying the symmetry first. Mm. If you can see the symmetry, planar, cylindrical, spherical, then you can choose a Gaussian surface that mirrors it.
And that choice makes the flux calculation, which could be a messy integral, much, much simpler, often just E times area.
Exactly. It turns calculus into algebra, essentially, by exploiting symmetry.
And it's amazing how these idealized models, infinite lines, infinite planes, give us such fundamental insights that are actually good approximations for real-world objects under the right conditions.
Right. They form the building blocks.
Yeah.
Which leads us to a final thought, maybe something for you, the listener, to chew on. How could we take these fundamental results, the field of a line, a plane, a sphere, and use them, perhaps with the principle of superposition, to figure out the fields for more complex, maybe less symmetric, real-world charge setups?
Like adding up the fields from different simple shapes.
Maybe. But also, what are the hard limits here? When does Gauss's law just stop being the easy way out because there isn't enough symmetry? And when can we confidently use these infinite results as good approximations for things that are, you know, just really big but not truly infinite?
Those are great questions. Thinking about the scope and limitations and how these idealized tools connect back to the complexity of the real world, that's definitely something to ponder.